Disc 8. Chapter 29. The Bird's Nest. The person is a very small thing. Actually, it is a composite. It cannot be said to exist by itself. Unperceived, it is just not there. It is but the shadow of the mind, the sum total of memories. Pure being is reflected in the mirror of the mind, as knowing. What is known takes the shape of a person, based on memory and habit. It is but a shadow, or a projection of the knower onto the screen of the mind. Nisargadatta Maharaj. Ego is a bird's nest, haphazardly collected and carelessly placed, shaped by every bit of debris and every breeze that has ever passed its way. Once you start tearing it apart, you'll actually find very little to identify with, and even less that was consciously placed there by you. And even then, you who? The self that takes part in the creation and development of self was not itself the product of self, but of countless non-self agencies and events. So what is self, really? You can try to take control of yourself, try to make some sense of it, organize it, but all you can really do is tidy up on the surface. Some egos are more cluttered, some less, but the idea that a true self lurks within the clutter is just one of the little vanities that keeps us walking in small, purposeful circles. There is no such thing as true self. Realizing that you have no idea who you are is the beginning of finding out who you are. The idea of the individual self, valid and separate, unravels very quickly under any serious scrutiny. All beliefs do. What takes time and effort is becoming the person who chooses to put the idea of self under such scrutiny, and making sense of what's left after the belief is gone.
Jed, what you call the first step. That breakdown I suffered at your house is nothing so innocuous as a step at all. It's a nuclear holocaust of the self, a personal Armageddon. A post-apocalyptic nightmare metaphor feels in some respects so accurate that an actual post-apocalyptic nightmare would seem like a vain pretender. This is real, and everything else is, as you say, just an image flickering on the wall. All I am is a frightened little bundle of opinions and memories and desires. That's all anyone is. I'm just amazed that everyone isn't like me, doing what I'm doing, ripping away their bullshit as fast as they can. I guess that's what being asleep means, living with it. I wish I could rip open my ribcage and pull out my heart and just be done with it. But no, that would be too easy. Even now, I wonder if the first step isn't the only step, and the rest of the process is just a matter of wandering through the barren landscape, sifting through debris, identifying bodies, and taking note of their passing. Acknowledging. Grieving. Moving on. Is this just some poetic bullshit? I have to watch myself at all times so I don't lapse into schoolgirl sentimentality. But no, this is as close as I can get to saying what this is like, a post-apocalyptic landscape, ruined, desolate, hopeless. My ambitions, my desires, my connections to people, my hopes, my dreams, my beliefs, the very things that I considered the very essence of me, are now reduced to hollow, lifeless corpses. So dead, it's like they were never alive. So fragile, they collapse in heaps of ash when touched by a gaze. I come across more of them every day. Oh, there are my career ambitions. They were such a big part of me, so important. Funny I didn't notice them missing. Now I can't even remember what they really were or why I really had them. I can't even imagine having such a thing as a career ambition now. Oh, there are my girlish childhood dreams, man, wedding, house, babies. Was I that little girl? I no longer feel that connection, so it doesn't really feel like a loss. Good Lord, my views, my tastes, my preferences. Did I really haul that crap around with me? That's how it is every day as I uncover more of these aspects of my former self, some greater, some lesser. I don't grieve for any of them, even those I held most dear. I simply mark their passing, dry-eyed, shell-shocked, and move on. I walk through this scorched land day after day, using this writing process to make sense of the carnage, to process my losses. What I fear most, though, isn't what I'll find among the dead, but among the survivors. There are survivors, I know. I have a sense of them, dark, formless things. It's petrifying to even think about this. There are things roaming in this devastated landscape of self that I am going to have to hunt down and kill. Things that a nuclear blast couldn't destroy. I have no illusions about this. My sanity is so marginal now that I've thought on several occasions of submitting myself for a 7-day psychiatric evaluation. Oh, yes, I've looked into it. I've made the calls. The number is in my cell phone's memory. They would understand nothing of what I'm going through, of course. But I feel like one big exposed nerve, and the idea of being doped into oblivion has an alarmingly seductive appeal.
We need the boundaries ego provides. They're a necessary part of life in the amusement park. Self is the complex, shifting set of dimensions that give us shape and form, and which distinguish us from other shapes and forms. The amusement park isn't come as you are. It has a dress code. It's a costume party, and who you come as doesn't matter, only that you come as someone. You can't come as no one. Julie is in the park and has slipped off into a quiet corner in order to divest herself of the costume she wears. No simple feat, this, as the wearer has no hands to use or will to use them. It is effectively the costume itself which must summon the will to ruthlessly rip itself away. Ego must slay ego. Only ego can. Who else? Physical suicide is just a shadow of this true self-destruction.
Opinions! Jesus, where did I get all those idiotic opinions? I wore them like a little girl wears her mother's makeup and costume jewelry. Look at me. I have a unique opinion. Look at my wonderful opinion. I think this. I think that. Look how special I am. I'll admire yours if you admire mine. I know this is just a normal growing pain, but seriously, what a buffoon. What a fool. I now despise all adornment, all affectation, all cosmetic enhancement. All I want to see is the real thing. The beauty is in the real thing. The thing itself. I would rather look at carrion at the feast, a lone cloud, a fly on the back of my hand, than all the paintings in the Louvre. More poetic bullshit, maybe. But I find myself happily looking at things that once seemed like nothings. I'm changing, and my world changes with me. I am coming to understand Whitman directly. I don't see what could be more beautiful than water dripping from a rusty pipe. I used to hate my feet. Now time seems to stand still as I look at them, and I see the same perfection to be seen in everything. I wonder if this isn't really the one thing Whitman said again and again. A morning glory at my window satisfies me more than the metaphysics of books. Everywhere is this perfection, like a clear note sweetly sounded. And the only thing that can ruin it and make it sour is the attempt to improve it. And the only thing that does that is ego. The false self ever strikes the false note. Fine, it's poetic bullshit, but it's true, so fuck it. Is it possible that I could now give birth to a child and view it with indifference? It doesn't seem possible. But I don't see how it could be otherwise. People think that the connection between two beings takes place at a deep level, But I wonder if it isn't just a deeper level of the outer garment. Must be. What else? Without that garment, there is no contact point. Or maybe one becomes one single undifferentiating contact point, fluidly, dynamically connected with all that is. I don't know. I don't think so. Something has always stuck with me from one of Castaneda's books. As I recall, Don Juan's nephew was killed in a motorcycle accident, and Don Juan was able to shift between two aspects of himself, one racked by grief for the loss of a loved one, but then switching out of it, not over the course of days or hours, but in an instant. Just like snapping his fingers, he shifted into his impersonal self and observed the death of his nephew with perfect indifference. I recall thinking that was some sorcerer bullshit when I read it, however long ago. But now it's not the indifferent part of the switching part I have doubts about, but the feeling part. Does that stay? Can I keep it? It doesn't seem possible. You mentioned this, Jed. You told me about the place in the Tao where it says there is no place for death to enter, and in the Gita where it says fire cannot burn nor wind make it dry. That's about this. But there's more to be said about it. The part where death enters is also where life enters. There's no place for another being to connect with. I don't understand all this, even in theory. Humans connect ego to ego. The heart is a part of the ego. The ego is the external self, the false self, the self that doesn't survive this awakening. I remember literally hundreds of discussions by spiritual seekers and teachers, and I remember reading about this in books and magazine articles, but I don't remember it ever making sense. And now that I'm here, now that it's me, it still doesn't. So I ask again and again, if I had a child, would I bond with it, even though I no longer have a bonding surface? Would I love my own child? I am certain the answer is no. And I am certain the answer can't be no.
In taking the first step, Julie has effectively stepped from an airplane without a parachute. Now she's in free fall. She may fear that she's going to suffer a bloody impact with the planet hurtling up to greet her, but that's just a residual fear pattern that no longer applies. At the precise moment of impact, the planet will disappear, and nothing will take its place. Her free fall won't end, but it will no longer feel like falling because there will no longer be anything to reference it against. No wind, no whoosh, no fast approaching planet. This is where dual awareness ends. From then on, she will live in boundless awareness, never again able to differentiate between self and non-self. Abiding, non-dual awareness. If she has a baby, will she love it? It's an interesting question and gives rise to others. In a sort of tongue-in-cheek way, I've said that a massive head wound would probably return me to some form of pre-realized state. Could parenthood do it? I don't know. Like Julie, I don't see how it could. Unlike Julie, I do see how it couldn't.
I bought a copy of the screenplay for the Mahabharata by Jean-Claude Carrère and Peter Brook. I love reading it. I've already ruined it with dog-eared pages and penned notes. In the Gita part, Krishna tells Arjuna he must rise up, free from hope, and throw himself into the battle. That phrase has seared into my mind. Free from hope. Abandon all hope, ye who enter here. The battle is absolute. It would be so nice if it weren't. It would be so nice if I could convince myself that by meditating for 6 hours a day, or by prostrating myself at the feet of a master, or by renouncing something I like, I could change the truth. This isn't what I signed up for. I find myself seeking distraction, diversion, anything that might allow me a way out of this. But this is consuming me from the inside and never eases up for a second. There is no way out. And the part of me that wishes there were is the cause of my suffering. I always heard and believed that the spiritual journey was one of peace and inner equanimity, of love and light, tranquility and acceptance. Well, that's not the journey I'm on. Mine is a maddening cacophony of dark emotions, a raging din of anger, hatred, contempt, scorn, and disgust, much of it directed at myself. I wrote for 10 straight hours last night. I barely remember it. I looked at what I wrote this morning, and it's like puke, like emotional vomit, like I just had this tremendous amount of vile, wretched, awfulness in me, and it erupted out and just kept pouring out as if from a bottomless source. It's not bottomless. I know it's not. But knowing rationally isn't the same as knowing. I'm making progress. It's so ephemeral in one sense and so perfectly specific in another. There's no stopping, I see that. You can't pause, can't stop to rest, can't exert any control over the speed of things. One thing finishes and the next thing starts right up, layer after layer, no standing still. I do my breathing and try to make a point of getting decent sleep, but the only way that really happens is when I go to bed exhausted. I have no schedule anymore. I sleep when I sleep. I'm all over the place. My energy is good, but I look like hell. Read, write, walk, sleep, that's all I do. How could anyone go through this with people around? Or holding down a normal job and a life? Or without this writing process? They'd have to try to exert some control over it. And from where I'm looking, no way. It couldn't be done. This is a wildfire, not a backyard barbecue. They'd end up in the nut house for sure.
Chapter 30. Distrust all honest fellows. The words of U.G. Krishnamurti. Part 3. I'll sing this song the rest of my life until I drop dead. Whether anybody listens to it or not is of no importance to me. U.G. Krishnamurti. The third and final selection of excerpts from U.G. Krishnamurti. If anyone makes you believe you can get somewhere, he's taking you for a ride. He may be honest. Distrust all honest fellows. Throw them out. There is no one who is honest in this field. No outside agency can help you. I wish you the best of luck. I know very well that it is not something that you or anybody else can get or that anybody can give. I can't give it. If there is somebody who promises, he is just promising, and he is going to take you for a long ride. He is just kidding you. He cannot deliver the goods, so he says, next life, or 10 years hence. He is safe. You can't be interested in this. How can you be interested in this? That is my question. How can you be interested in this kind of a thing? What you are interested in is a totally different thing, fancy stuff, fantasy. You may indulge in all kinds of fantasy. That's your affair. If this is not fantasy, you will be interested in some other kind of fantasy. How can you be interested in liquidating yourself? That is my question. All that you know, you as you know yourself, you as you experience yourself, is interested in continuity. It knows all the tricks. You cannot beat that. I am not interested in the whole field of self-expression, getting in touch with one's feelings, overcoming inhibitions, and so on. I respond to what people come to see me about, the natural state. If people are interested in psychological change, so-called consciousness expansion and all that, let them go to encounter groups or see psychiatrists and engage in what I call the Freudian fraud. In the end, their so-called growth will not bring them happiness, and neither will their improved sex lives, if their sex lives improve. At best, they will simply have learned to be unhappy in a new and richer way. Everything is okay with me. If you have $1 million and 8 girlfriends, that's okay with me. If you are lonely and disagreeable and penniless and dying of cancer, that also is okay with me. I am perfectly happy with everything as it is. I am happy with misery, poverty, and death. I am also happy with wealth and psychological fulfillment. Asked about Buddha and Christ. Why do you bother about those fellows? They are dead. You should pitch them in the river. And yet you don't. You keep listening to someone, it makes no difference whom, and you keep hoping that somehow, tomorrow or the next day, by listening more and more, you will get off the merry-go-round. You listen to your parents and to your teachers at school, and they tell you to be good and dutiful and not be angry and so on, and that doesn't do any good. And so you go and learn how to do yoga. And then presently some old chap comes along and tells you to be choicelessly aware. Or maybe you find someone in the holy business, and he does miracles. He produces some trinkets out of the air, and you fall for it. Or perhaps he touches you, and you see some blue light, or green light, or yellow light, or God knows what, and you hope he will help you experience enlightenment. But he cannot help you. It is not something that can be captured, contained, or given expression to. I do not know if you see the utter helplessness of the situation, and how, if anyone thinks he can help you, he will inevitably mislead you. And the less phony he is, the more powerful he is. The more enlightened he is, the more misery and mischief he will create for you. But you are waiting for something to happen, or for some grace to descend upon you. You are still depending upon some outside agency. I can tell you that there is no power outside of you. No power. This does not mean that you have all the attributes that you read about of the super-duper gods, but there is no power outside of you. If there is any power in this universe, it is in you. There is no self to be realized. The whole religious structure that has been built on this foundation collapses because there is nothing there to realize. To me, J. Krishnamurti, here UG refers to Jiddu Krishnamurti, an acquaintance, not a relation, is playing exactly the same game as all those ugly saints in the market whom we have in the world today. Krishnamurti's teaching is phony baloney. There is nothing to his teaching at all, and he cannot produce anything at all. A person may listen to him for 60, 70, or 100 years, but nothing will ever happen to that man, because the whole thing is phony. Here's a mere wordsmith. He has created a new trap. These gurus are the worst egotists the world has ever seen. All gurus are welfare organizations providing petty experiences to their followers. The guru game is a profitable industry. Try and make $2 million a year any other way. Even J. Krishnamurti, who claims he has no possessions, is the president of an $80 million empire. What prevents you from understanding what you want to understand is the very thing which you are using to understand things. This is not my teaching or anybody's teaching, but this is the only thing. You are trying to understand something through an instrument which is not the instrument to understand. Questioner. Yes, but if there is no yes, but you can't say yes and begin the next sentence with but. There is no but there. If the yes is a real yes, that releases the thing there. The yes fades into nothingness, and then what is there begins to express itself. If you say but, you are giving continuity to that dead structure of thought, experience, and hope. Yes is the thing that blows the whole structure apart. As long as you follow somebody else's path, the path is the product of thought, so it is actually not a new path. It's the same old path, and you are playing the same old game in a new way. It is not a new game. It is the same old game that you are playing all the time. But you think you are playing a new game. When you see the absurdity of what you're doing, maybe you'll realize, what the hell have I been doing for 30 years, 40 years, 50 years? One thing I must say. This is not born out of thinking. This is not a logically ascertained premise that I am putting forth. These are just words springing up from their natural source without any thought structure. So take it or leave it. You will be better off if you leave it. Your teacher must go. It doesn't matter who the teacher is. The very thing that you are reading, that's the very thing you must be free from. Questioner, sir, what is your message? It is quite simple. You are not going to get anything here. You are wasting your time. Pack up and go. That is my message. I have nothing to give. You have nothing to take. If you continue to sit there, you are wasting your time. The one thing you have to do is get up and go. Chapter 31. Man, deprogram thyself. Until I was 25, I had no development at all. From my 25th year, I date my life. 3 weeks have scarcely passed at any time between then and now that I have not unfolded within myself. But I feel that I am now come to the inmost leaf of the bulb, and that shortly the flower must fall to the mold. Herman Melville, in a letter to Nathaniel Hawthorne. Julie uses all the teachers and teachings her journalistic career put her in touch with as an important part of her process. Many of those people and their ideas resonated with her, found a place to dwell within her, and became a part of her, so that much of what she's doing now involves discovering where and why these resonations occurred, and, by so doing, determining the contours of her own false self. One teacher Julie spent time with ascribed great importance to introspective self-discovery techniques such as journaling, group dialogues, and sessions with the teacher as a means of clearing out the internal debris that keeps us from knowing our true self and pristinely mirroring the divine love of the universe. I'm describing it poorly because all I have to go on is Julie's delightfully lunatic ravings. But the point is that because the teaching found a place inside her, Julie can now find that same place and use the teachings to which she originally responded as a surface against which to pit herself. In this way, many of her battles are fought against real opponents, visibly personified and made practically assailable. All that most maddens and torments, all that stirs up the lees of things, all truth with malice in it, all that cracks the sinews and cakes the brain, all the subtle demonisms of life and thought, all evil, to crazy Ahab, were visibly personified and made practically assailable in Moby Dick. Because the subtle demonisms of life and thought can be as formless and shifting as vapor, the person on a search-and-destroy mission must have a way of making them practically assailable. Spiritual autolysis, trying to write something true and keeping at it until you do, is the best possible way of identifying and eradicating our falseness, because the process of writing minimizes the weaknesses and maximizes the strengths of the intellect. Nothing false can survive illumination by a steady and focused mind.
Several years ago, I was assigned to interview a well-known teacher and author of several books.
I was with him for 3 weeks in Vancouver and Seattle. He spoke knowledgeably and convincingly about the enlightened perspective, the enlightened path, and the enlightened humanity of the not-too-distant future. Whenever he spoke, I just lapped it up, like he was blessing me with his words. I sat there taking my notes, nodding and smiling, totally uncritical, totally absorbed, totally taken in by his saintly appearance and reputation. I look back on it now and shudder at my gullibility. He talked about how the enlightened perspective was one of compassion and unconditional love. I'd love to do that interview over now. Enlightened perspective, compassion. How could I have been so catatonic that I just sat there and let him get away with that? Some journalist. What a brainwashed sheep I was. Put that man in front of me now. I laugh to think of it. I feel as if my gaze alone would be sufficient to dissipate him, or that I could step right through him and meet no resistance. I wouldn't have to speak. I could destroy him simply by seeing him clearly.
Which is effectively what she's doing now, destroying thoughts with thought, seeing things clearly. It helps to put a face on the enemy of the moment. But her rage is not against any of her former teachers. It's against her own attachment to them, which is inside her, a part of her. Of the several hundred battles she will fight and win, more than a dozen, from what I can tell, will be against spiritual teachers whose ideas have taken up residence within her, including, eventually, me.
Man, know thyself is bullshit. Man, deprogram thyself. That's what it's all about. Even as I write this, I feel like my soul is twisted with some dark mass of hatred and resentment. But I also know that that's how it should be. That's how the process works. Every step is like a slow-motion explosion, starting as a spark, growing in intensity, blooming into a violent, fiery ball, and finally erupting into a purifying, all-consuming, white-hot inferno, destroying everything and leaving nothing where there once stood a mountain. I mean, again and again, every few days, that's what this is. Boom, boom, boom. Each step starts as an itch, grows into an agony, and erupts into a conflagration. Every molecule that burns is a molecule of me. What is being burned in this process is the false me, and every step is its own protracted battle. This is no mere intellectual challenge. I get past one obstacle, and I have a moment's peace before the next starts coming into view. It starts out small and distant, but grows larger and larger until it looms impossibly large before me. These are my demons. But they weren't demons when I let them in. They were cuddly little bundles of warmth and happiness and safety. But now that I want to get to the heart of things, they are tenacious little monsters, and each must be ruthlessly slain. There is no choice, no decision to make. I kill them and dissect them, and I see them for exactly what they are, the web of self I have spun to shield me from reality. Everything I do to assert and define self is truly to deny no self. Nothing is so ridiculous or petty that it doesn't trace back to the one root from which all my choices and actions stem. All of life reduces to the projection of the false and the denial of the true. The false self must be constantly asserted like a leaky balloon that we have to keep blowing into. But what if we stop blowing into it? What then? What then? We'll see what's left when life support is unplugged. That's how we find out what's real. Who we really are and aren't. How simple it is, really. This doesn't require philosophy or religion or white-bearded old men. It just requires honesty.
What took me nearly 2 years to accomplish, Julie might do in much less time. I came into the process a spiritual and philosophical illiterate. I had an advantage in that I had long since determined that reality had no basis in reality. But I didn't have the benefit, as Julie does, of having representatives of the world's great systems of thought already inhabiting my mind, neatly lined up, smallest to largest, for me to practice my swordsmanship on.
I no longer transfer my authority to another. I do not defer or relinquish. Now I'm seeing it for myself, and I see that nothing is okay. It's the exact opposite of okay. What can possibly be okay if your life is a lie? If who you are is a fiction? It's that simple. What else matters? What else is there? There are no winners. There is no success. If your life is a lie, then who you are and what you are is a lie. There's no response to that. You either roll over and go back to sleep, or you start chewing through the ropes.
Also, unlike Julie, I didn't have a Jed McKenna. I didn't find anyone like she's found in me. My experience was one of inventing and discovering the process as I went. It is because I did go through that, and because discovering the process was so much a part of my process, that I was able to become the guy that wrote the book that makes the whole ordeal a bit less of an ordeal for Julie and others who want to get to the first step and make sense of what comes after, or just steer clear of the whole mess.
How many people do I know or know of who've put all their spiritual eggs in the meditation basket? How many who think that all their time spent in meditation is adding up to something, building up in them, moving them closer to something? I know people who've meditated their butts off for years. And where are they now? Right where they started. It can't happen that way. I know it can't, because I know what it is. Meditation equals medication. It's like medicating patients in the nut house, or better yet, convincing them to medicate themselves and to ratchet up the dosage anytime they feel the slightest twinge of spiritual dyspepsia. Nurse Ratchet. Someday I'll read Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with very different eyes.
The heretic theme appears occasionally in film and literature. Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society is an example. The movie Pleasantville is a happy tale of heresy. The town of Pleasantville is frozen in a black and white 1950s Mayberry-esque sensibility. Then along comes the unwitting heretic from a larger world of full color and open minds, where the roads don't circle around, but keep on going. His awakeness leads to the gradual awakening of the community. There is resistance, but the town folk don't burn him at the stake, and, in the end, everyone embraces the new paradigm. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is about the same thing, a tale of heresy, but a little less cheery as regards the fate of the heretic and the fruits of heresy. And written, I should add, by the heretic who wrote Further on the front of a bus and drove it straight up the ass of a sleeping giant.
I'd rather burn in hell now and forever than to continue living in that suffocating prison of lies. You hear the word ego and you think of psychology and personality, but ego isn't personality structure. It's the structure of confinement. That and nothing else. Nothing else. What did you say in your book, Jed? There's nothing to say about it, nothing to feel about it, nothing to know about it. Of course. Of course. There's not one single thing that matters about the dream except that you're in a dream. Wake up! I understand fear now. I know what it is, how total it is. You can look at yourself and not see it because you don't see anything that's not it. I know that I wasn't afraid. I was fear. What is Christianity but a two-bit protection racket? Good cop, bad cop, the Son, our blessed Savior, saving us from what? From his psychotic freak show father who's hell-bent on burning us alive forever? What kind of twisted fuck thinks this stuff up? What kind of pathetic slob falls for it? My kind. Me. I did. I wasn't above it. I wasn't immune. And now that I'm flushing this poison from my system, I can see the secret of its hold over us. I know, Jed. I know. Whatever is right. I know that. I do. But Jesus Christ, is it any wonder that the human race is spiritually retarded? the opiate of the masses, they say about religion. But it's not, not really, because no one is immune. No one is outside of this opium dream looking in at the dope fiends. The rich and powerful are every bit as narcotized as the poor and weak, the atheist as much as the devout. I'm starting to see how deep this separation runs, how pervasive it truly is.
Ego as a structure of confinement is an apt analogy, but slightly misleading. Jails wall in, ego walls out. A minor distinction, perhaps, but a critical one. Whatever's out there isn't holding us in. We're holding it out. We are our own keepers. We can open the door and walk out whenever we want. Of course, the thing one leaves isn't just the prison of self, but self itself. So the freedom thus won is something of a booby prize. Julie may rage against the fear that confines us in one email and display a calm understanding and respect for it in the next. Fear looks like evil when you're trying to escape from it, but it looks very sensible and necessary when you're not. You can say fear and ignorance are bad and that Maya is evil, but that's a low-level perspective. For this whole dualistic universe thing to work, it's important that everyone doesn't just go wandering off, that they stay on stage and play their role. Fear is the glue that holds the whole thing together and keeps everyone in character. Julie understands that, intellectually at least.
I was out walking today, and I was so overcome by happiness that I had to skip. I haven't skipped since I got interested in boys. I skipped through the woods and sang loud idiot songs, and I jumped up and down on the earth so it knew I was here. Tilly came bounding along with me, leaping and yipping. I think we bonded. I suddenly realized that after more than a year of this agonizing upheaval, I have absolutely nothing to show for it. And that thought was just too funny. It was like the dam had burst. I have no wisdom, no knowledge, nothing to impart, all this hell, and I have nothing to show for it. I have acquired nothing, gained nothing. How perfect. The word wise fool popped into my head right then, and it felt perfect. What a great word. I've become so delightfully stupid that I really enjoy being with myself. I think it might be because I don't think about things too much anymore. I can't believe how much of my life I've spent in thought. Think, all day long, as if there was anything to think about. What was I thinking? When this is over, I vow never to think again. Disgusting habit.
To become an adult human is like being born anew into an unimaginably different world and having to figure out where you are and how everything works. You come to see, as Julie has, that thought, our primary method for understanding life, is really our way of walling ourselves off from it. We translate the world into our artificial language of symbols and concepts in order to avoid knowing it directly. When I heard the learned astronomer, when the proofs, the figures were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and the diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I, sitting, heard the astronomer, where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon, unaccountable, I became tired and sick, till rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself in the mystical moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars. Walt Whitman. The world is too much with us, late and soon. Getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. We have given our hearts away, a sordid boon. The sea that bears her bosom to the moon, the winds that will be howling at all hours, and are upgathered now like sleeping flowers. For this, for everything, we are out of tune. it moves us not. Great God, I'd rather be a pagan suckled in a creed outworn. So might I, standing on this pleasant lea, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn, have sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn. William Wordsworth. When the intervening layer of symbols and concepts is removed, the terrain and self are seen as one, and the rules of motion and navigation become radically different. This is the true but seldom realized potential of the human being. These are the new and better senses and abilities to be mastered. We learn to accept and reject, to push and be pulled, to shape and be shaped. We learn to detect lines of flow and to follow them smoothly between and around obstructions. We learn to see patterns and merge with them. If we don't learn these things, then we're out of tune with our energetic environment and can only stumble and grope, like birds that can't fly, or fish that can't swim, or like most of the people we think of as normally developed. It's a whole art and science thing, and what you are and how it works are really the same, so that learning one is learning both. Chapter 32. This is, and no mistake. Selections from the writings of Henry David Thoreau. In what concerns you much, do not think that you have companions. Know that you are alone in the world. H.D. Thoreau. I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. I did not wish to live what was not life. Living is so dear, nor did I wish to practice resignation, unless it was quite necessary. I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to live so sturdily and Spartan-like as to put to rout all that was not life, to cut a broad swath and shave close, to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms, and, if it proved to be mean, why then to get the whole and genuine meanness of it and publish its meanness to the world, or, if it were sublime, to know it by experience and to be able to give a true account of it in my next excursion. Time is but the stream I go a-fishing in. I drink at it, but while I drink I see the sandy bottom and detect how shallow it is. Its thin current slides away, but eternity remains. I would drink deeper. Fish in the sky, whose bottom is pebbly with stars. I cannot count one. I know not the first letter of the alphabet. I have always been regretting that I was not as wise as the day I was born. Men esteem truth remote, in the outskirts of the system, behind the farthest star, before Adam and after the last man. In eternity, there is indeed something true and sublime, but all these times and places and occasions are now and here. Let us settle ourselves and work and wedge our feet downward through the mud and slush of opinion and prejudice and tradition and delusion and appearance, that alluvion which covers the globe, through Paris and London, through New York and Boston and Concord, through church and state, through poetry and philosophy and religion, till we come to a hard bottom and rocks in place, which we can call reality, and say, this is, and no mistake. If you stand right fronting and face to face to a fact, you will see the sun glimmer on both its surfaces as if it were a scimitar, and feel its sweet edge dividing you through the heart and marrow, and so you will happily conclude your mortal career. Be it life or death, we crave only reality. If we are really dying, let us hear the rattle in our throats and feel cold in the extremities. If we are alive, let us go about our business. Shams and delusions are esteemed for soundest truths, while reality is fabulous. If men would steadily observe realities only, and not allow themselves to be deluded, life, to compare it with such things as we know, would be like a fairy tale and the Arabian Nights entertainments. If we respected only what is inevitable and has a right to be, music and poetry would resound along the streets. When we are unhurried and wise, we perceive that only great and worthy things have any permanent and absolute existence, that petty fears and petty pleasures are but the shadow of the reality. This is always exhilarating and sublime. By closing the eyes and slumbering and consenting to be deceived by shows, men establish and confirm their daily life of routine and habit everywhere, which still is built on purely illusory foundations. Children who play life discern its true law and relations more clearly than men who fail to live it worthily, but who think that they are wiser by experience, that is, by failure. The millions are awake enough for physical labor, but only one in a million is awake enough for effective intellectual exertion. Only one in 100 millions to a poetic or divine life. To be awake is to be alive. I have never yet met a man who was quite awake. How could I have looked him in the face? If one listens to the faintest but constant suggestions of his genius, which are certainly true, he sees not to what extremes, or even insanity, it may lead him. And yet that way, as he grows more resolute and faithful, his road lies. The faintest assured objection which one healthy man feels will at length prevail over the arguments and customs of mankind. No man ever followed his genius till it misled him. Though the result were bodily weakness, yet perhaps no one can say that the consequences were to be regretted, for these were a life in conformity to higher principles. He is the best sailor who can steer within fewest points of the wind and exact a motive power out of the greatest obstacles. Why level downward to our dullest perception always, and praise that as common sense? The commonest sense is the sense of men asleep, which they express by snoring. There are nowadays professors of philosophy, but not philosophers. Yet it is admirable to profess because it was once admirable to live. To be a philosopher is not merely to have subtle thoughts, nor even to found a school, but so to love wisdom as to live according to its dictates, a life of simplicity, independence, magnanimity, and trust. It is to solve some of the problems of life, not only theoretically, but practically. The success of great scholars and thinkers is commonly a courtier-like success, not kingly, not manly. They make shift to live merely by conformity, practically as their fathers did, and are in no sense the progenitors of a nobler race of men. Not till we are lost, in other words, not till we have lost the world, do we begin to find ourselves and realize where we are and the infinite extent of our relations. Books, not which afford us a cowering enjoyment, but in which each thought is of unusual daring, such as an idle man cannot read, and a timid one would not be entertained by, which even make us dangerous to existing institutions, such call I good books. I learned this, at least by my experiment, that if one advances confidently in the direction of his dreams, and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with a success unexpected in common hours. He will put some things behind, will pass an invisible boundary. New, universal, and more liberal laws will begin to establish themselves around and within him, or the old laws be expanded and interpreted in his favor in a more liberal sense, and he will live with the license of a higher order of beings. In proportion as he simplifies his life, the laws of the universe will appear less complex, and solitude will not be solitude, nor poverty poverty, nor weakness weakness. Chapter 33, The Symphony. From beneath his slouched hat, Ahab dropped a tear into the sea, nor did all the Pacific contain such wealth as that one wee drop. Herman Melville, Moby Dick. Chapter 132, The Symphony, is the true final chapter of Moby Dick. Although the book contains three more chapters and an epilogue, this is where Ahab's final battle is fought and won. Those three concluding chapters can really be considered a very exciting wrap-up, an extended epilogue. The white whale is spotted and chased for 3 days. Ahab delivers his final speech and harpoons Moby Dick. The rope catches Ahab around the neck and pulls him under. Everybody dies but Ishmael. In this chapter, The Symphony, Ahab the man takes a final look back over the life that has brought him to this end. He considers his lost humanity and sees in it the magic glass of Starbuck's eye. Starbuck is the first mate, a responsible Nantucketer and Quaker, a respected whaleman, a father and a husband, all things that Ahab was and, from Starbuck's perspective, could be again. Starbuck, knowing that a dire fate awaits ship and crew, and seeing a chance to change it, pleads for Ahab to let him turn the boat for home. Ahab, at his most sentimental and vulnerable, need only give the slightest nod of his head, and the cup will be taken from him. That's it. That's how close Ahab is, even at the last, to full reprieve. That's how easy it would be, at least, so it appears to Starbuck. Fedallah sits, so to speak, on Ahab's other shoulder. It was a clear, steel-blue day. The firmaments of air and sea were hardly separable in that all-pervading azure. Only the pensive air was transparently pure and soft, with a woman's look, and the robust and manlike sea heaved with long, strong, lingering swells, as Samson's chest in his sleep, hither and thither, on high glided the snow-white wings of small, unspeckled birds. These were the gentle thoughts of the feminine air. But to and fro in the deeps, far down in the bottomless blue, rushed mighty leviathans, swordfish and sharks. And these were the strong, troubled, murderous thinkings of the masculine sea. But though thus contrasting within, the contrast was only in shades and shadows without. Those two seemed one. It was only the sex, as it were, that distinguished them. Aloft, like a royal czar and king, the sun seemed giving this gentle air to this bold and rolling sea, even as bride to groom. And at the girdling line of the horizon, a soft and tremulous motion, most seen here at the equator, denoted the fond, throbbing trust, the loving alarms with which the poor bride gave her bosom away. Tied up and twisted, gnarled and knotted with wrinkles, haggardly firm and unyielding, his eyes glowing like coals that still glow in the ashes of ruin, untottering Ahab stood forth in the clearness of the morn, lifting his splintered helmet of a brow to the fair girl's forehead of heaven. Oh, immortal infancy and innocency of the azure, invisible winged creatures that frolic all round us, sweet childhood of air and sky, how oblivious were ye of old Ahab's close-coiled woe. But so have I seen little Miriam and Martha, laughing-eyed elves, heedlessly gamble around their old sire, sporting with the circle of singed locks which grew on the marge of that burnt-out crater of his brain. Slowly crossing the deck from the scuttle, Ahab leaned over the side and watched how his shadow in the water sank and sank to his gaze, and more, and the more that he strove to pierce profundity. But the lovely aromas in that enchanted air did at last seem to dispel, for a moment, the cankerous thing in his soul. That glad, happy air, that winsome sky, did at last stroke and caress him. The stepmother world, so long cruel, forbidding, now threw affectionate arms round his stubborn neck, and did seem to joyously sob over him, as if over one that, however willful and erring, she could yet find it in her heart to save and to bless. From beneath his slouched hat, Ahab dropped a tear into the sea. Nor did all the Pacific contain such wealth as that one wee drop. Starbuck saw the old man, saw him, how he heavily leaned over the side, and he seemed to hear in his own true heart the measureless sobbing that stole out of the center of the serenity around. Careful not to touch him or be noticed by him, he yet drew near to him and stood there. Ahab turned.
Starbuck!
Sir?
Oh, Starbuck, it is a mild, mild wind and a mild-looking sky. On such a day, very much such a sweetness as this, I struck my first whale, a boy harpooner of 18. 40 years ago. Ago. 40 years of continual wailing. 40 years of privation and peril and storm time. 40 years on the pitiless sea. For 40 years has Ahab forsaken the peaceful land. For 40 years to make war on the horrors of the deep. Aye. And yes, Starbuck, out of those 40 years, I have not spent 3 ashore. When I think of this life I have led, the desolation of solitude it has been, the masoned, walled town of a captain's exclusiveness, which admits but small entrance to any sympathy from the green country without. Oh, weariness! Heaviness, Guinea Coast slavery of solitary command. When I think of all this, only half suspected, not so keenly known to me before, and how for 40 years I have fed upon dry, salted fare, fit emblem of the dry nourishment of my soul. When the poorest landsman has had fresh fruit to his daily hand, and broken the world's fresh bread to my moldy crusts. Away, whole oceans away, from that young girl wife I wedded past 50, and sailed for Cape Horn the next day, leaving but one dent in my marriage pillow. Wife? Wife? Rather a widow with her husband alive. I widowed that poor girl when I married her, Starbuck. And then, the madness, the frenzy, the boiling blood and the smoking brow with which, for 1,000 lowerings, old Ahab has furiously, foamingly chased his prey. More a demon than a man. Aye, what a 40 years fool. Fool, old fool. As old Ahab been? Why this strife of the chase? Why weary and palsy the arm at the oar, and the iron and the lance? How the richer or better is Ahab now? Behold, O Starbuck, is it not hard that with this weary load I bear, one poor leg should have been snatched from under me?
Here, brush this old hair aside. It blinds me that I seem to weep. Locks so gray did never grow but from out some ashes. But do I look very old? So very, very old, Starbuck.
I feel deadly faint, bowed and humped as though I were Adam, staggering beneath the piled centuries since paradise. God, 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 crack my heart, stave my brain. Mockery, mockery, bitter, biting mockery of gray hairs. Have I lived enough joy to wear ye and seem and feel thus intolerably old? Close, stand close to me, Starbuck. Let me look into a human eye. It is better than to gaze into sea or sky, better than to gaze upon God. By the green land, by the bright hearthstone, this is the magic glass, man. I see my wife and my child in thine eye. No, no, stay on board, on board. Lower not when I do. When branded Ahab gives chase to Moby Dick, that hazard shall not be thine. No, no, not with the faraway home I see in that eye.
Oh, my captain, noble soul, grand old heart. After all, why should anyone give chase to that hated fish? Away with me. Let us fly these deadly waters. Let us home. Wife and child, too, are Starbuck's. Wife and child of his brotherly, sisterly, playfellow youth. Even as thine, sir, are the wife and child of thy loving, longing, paternal old age. Away. Let us away. This instant, let me alter the course. How cheerily, how hilariously, oh, my captain, would we bowl on our way to see old Nantucket again? I think, sir, they have some such mild blue days, even as this in Nantucket. They have. I have seen them some summer days in the morning. About this time. Yes, it is his noon nap now. The boy vivaciously wakes, sits up in bed, and his mother tells him of me, of cannibal old me,
how I am abroad upon the deep, but will yet come back to dance him again. 'Tis my Mary herself. She promised that my boy, every morning, should be carried to the hill to catch the first glimpse of his father's sail. Yes, yes, no more. It is done. We head for Nantucket. Come, my captain, study out the course, and let us away. See, see, the boy's face from the window, the boy's hand on the hill.
But Ahab's glance was averted. Like a blighted fruit tree, he shook and cast his last cindered apple to the soil. What is it? What nameless, inscrutable, unearthly thing is it? What cozening, hidden lord and master and cruel, remorseless emperor commands me that against all natural lovings and longings I so keep pushing and crowding and jamming myself on all the time, recklessly making me ready to do what in my own proper natural heart I durst not so much as dare. Is Ahab Ahab? Is it I, God, or who that lifts this arm? But if the great sun move not of himself, but is as an errand boy in heaven, nor one single star can revolve, but by some invisible power, how then can this one small heart beat, this one small brain think thoughts, unless God does that beating, does that thinking, does that living, and not I? By heaven, man, we are turned round and round in this world, like yonder windlass, and fate is the hand spike. And all the time, lo, that smiling sky and this unsounded sea. Look, see ye yon albacore. Who put it into him to chase and fang that flying fish? Where do murderers go, man? Who's to doom? The judge himself is dragged to the bar. But it is a mild, mild wind, and a mild-looking sky, and the air smells now as if it blew from a far-away meadow. They have been making hay somewhere under the slopes of the Andy Starbuck, and the mowers are sleeping among the new-mown hay. Sleeping? Aye. Toil we how we may, we all sleep at last on the field.
Sleep? Aye, and rust amid greenness, as last year's scythes flung down, and left in the half-cut swathes. Starbuck!
But blanched to a corpse's hue with despair, the mate had stolen away. Ahab crossed the deck to gaze over on the other side, but started at two reflected, fixed eyes in the water there. Fadala was motionlessly leaning over the same rail.
End of Disc 8.